are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, May 26, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Friday. And this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, I moderate a conversation between Schmeckle and Schmooley, Sam and Cliff Schechter. Sam in a secret location, Cliff Schechter calling from his normal location, presumably in his usual bathrobe. Well, Greg Gianforte, he had a great 24 hours. He broke a reporter's glasses and he won a seat in Congress. What does that say about the Republicans' literal thuggery, Trump's war on the press? And if Democrats want to win races, maybe they ought to invest in them. Was a tight margin, though. We'll go over that race. Not surprising, but obviously very disappointing. Not good for the prospects of not destroying people's health care. Jared Kushner, dark days ahead. And maybe his dad cannot bribe his way out of this one. The FBI is actually looking at him. What is his role in the Russia story? And Donald Trump was in Brussels for a NATO summit, getting thoroughly humiliated by Emmanuel Macron and simply unable to convince people that he's anything other than insane. He undermined NATO Clause 5, called everybody, Article 5, rather, undermined the summit and shoved the president of Montenegro. We played that yesterday.
Prime Minister.
Ooh, I'm off. Seemed a lot more at home in Saudi. Though you'd think all the white people would comfort him. And another court has blocked Trump's Muslim ban. And part of the reason he did it was because he cannot keep his bloated, stupid mouth shut, undermining his own goals. And we have a whole bunch of sound for you. We're really going to tease out this full disaster in Brussels. Ben Carson says poverty is a state of mind. And Ken Langone says that food stamps, he knows what they're being used for. Yayo and ganja. So says the multi-billionaire co-founder of Home Depot and one of the most exceptional, horrible people on planet Earth. We'll get to all of that and more on today's Majority Report. No show on Monday. We're off for the Memorial Day weekend. I have my bags packed, ready to get up to lovely Massachusetts, swim in a lake, and sleep. Is everybody else, you guys getting out of town this weekend?
I might be going to Coney Island.
Look at you. Have you gone to Coney Island before?
Yeah, I've been to Coney Island a few times.
Have you gotten high, gone on the rides?
I don't do any of that stuff, but I did go to...
Wait, did your parents start listening to the show?
No, I don't know what you're talking about. Oh. Hi, Mom. I've been to a few baseball games out there. I like to do that.
That's good. I like that. That's a very appropriate spring New York activity. Kelly, what's on the docket?
A few things, but I'm not leaving town.
Not leaving town.
No.
Let's see. Do we have this Macron thing? It's very brief. It's a visual, but I'll walk everybody through it. We're just going to do this. We just do this really briefly. I'll spell it out for everybody that's listening, but I do encourage everybody to subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. So we played yesterday, and this was another visual. Macron mastered the Trump handshake maneuver. They were sitting there, and not only did he not allow Trump to do that weird pull-people-in thing, he also wouldn't let go of Trump's hand. when Trump was trying to get out of it. And obviously he was able to dominate because of how petite and small Trump's hands are. And now here he is. He's walking. This is basically a kind of blue carpet area. Macron is walking by himself, and there's a line of NATO leaders, including Angela Merkel, Donald Trump, and a couple of other heads of state. Macron is up front, and he's walking to meet this delegation. So he's walking head on. And Trump is obviously expecting, like, well, he's going to greet me first. Now, Macron cuts to the right, completely ignores Trump to shake Angela Merkel's hand. Then he shakes the guy next to Angela Merkel. Then he looks at Trump. Then he looks away. Then he goes back to the right and shakes someone else's hand before shaking hands with Trump. And just to pause it, I have to say, so first, goes to the right to Merkel, completely ignores Trump. Then goes to the left, Trump's to his left, goes to the guy in the middle, shakes hands, and Trump's like, all right, I'm going to get the shake now. Then he pivots back to the far right to shake hands with another head of state before finally going to Trump. Trump does the pull-in move. Macron does not allow it and actually puts his left hand on Trump's arm and literally pushes him back. Like, that's not happening.
And then watch the backpack game.
And then, yes. And then there's a little backpack game here. Trump does the, yeah, I still got you, a little pat on the shoulders. But Trump knows that this is the second exchange that he's gotten really, again, totally cucked and humiliated by Emmanuel Macron. The real kicker is, though, is that Macron did this perfectly. He did it long enough to be clear what he was doing, but short enough to have plausible deniability. But this morning, Emmanuel Macron's official Twitter account actually tweeted this exchange out. So I don't think there's any ambiguity about what's going on here. It's pretty hilarious.
If we have to have centrist neoliberals like Macron in charge, they have to be able to do stuff like that.
He's taking more after Obama in the sense of cool versus like the sort of Trudeau, like kind of goofy thing. Like he's coming out of the gate strong. So respect, and I agree with you. If we have to have mediocre neoliberals, at least they should be able to humiliate Donald Trump. It's not that much to ask for. We'll be right back with Sam Seder and Cliff Schechter on a casual Friday. It's the Majority Report. Yes, I am. Wow. Eternal fire, dirty Babylon, you are gonna get bruised. Me, I want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. We are want them. Ooh, yeah. I'm back up and one. Me, I beg you, move. Yeah. I beg you, back up and one. Me said that movement alive. Marcus said we organize and centralize. Rastafi own banks and enterprise. So me nah stop chanting my soul enter Zion. Princes of fire, Babylon me tell you your time just expire. What kind of wickedness me or your transpire? And no gasoline and a tire. Eternal fire, dirty Babylon you are gonna get bruised. Me I want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. We are one. I beg your papa one one, me I tell you move, I tell your papa one one, where them a go with a key and selfish when better them give me a key. Welcome back to the Majority Report, Michael Brooks. Joined now by Sam Seder from an undisclosed location and Cliff Schechter from a disclosed location. We actually have his home address up on the Majority Report blog. How are you guys doing?
Excellent.
I'm waiting to be doxxed.
I'm enjoying it. I always find that such nice people come by to say hello when that happens.
Well, you have the best doxxing experience in the world, Cliff. People just come by to like give you like pot brownies and stuff.
They do. Also, they're very kind to me because I've gone out of my way to only work on non-controversial issues like guns and abortion.
Right. I would imagine if you work on guns, you get a lot of like emails like, hey, I don't agree with you, but I respect your opinion and keep up the good work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like my board membership here in Ohio for Planned Parenthood. I find I get those reactions from them on that too. It's wonderful. They're very kind people.
Like, hey, we don't agree with this, but it's not like you're killing babies or anything.
This is sort of the best lead-in, of course, to the Gianforte situation, because some of these people actually would like to body slam me, probably. I'm too quick for them, you know, and so they can't catch me. If they can, I'm really weak, and they could probably do it pretty easily. That's what we got going on today. We don't have reporters just being arrested, like in West Virginia, or having to be escorted out of rallies Donald Trump is holding by Secret Service, like what happened with Katie Turr during the campaign. Now we have them actually legitimately being body slammed by candidates. We appear to have taken it to that next level.
And I would add into this mix, I mean, this is not just a question of reporters. I mean, I think, you know, they definitely, you know, there was that story of Sheriff Clark having, I don't know if you guys saw this, deputies meet some guy at an airport who apparently looked at him incorrectly
talked to him and asked him a question about something. I think I read that, Sam, and that you're right. Cause I don't think sometimes people make these connections and add in that essentially, whether it's constituents, whether it's, what's his name? Old Wilbur Ross talking about Saudi Arabia and how nice it was not to have protesters. this all is of the same mindset.
Well,
nobody can dare question them, whether it's reporters.
I'm just thinking, let's just add to the mix. I mean, obviously, going back to the Trump campaign, people getting punched for protesting and Trump saying, you know, people used to be brought out in a stretcher. And then also, why not add to the mix shoving the prime minister of Montenegro to get in the front of a photo op? I mean, it all happened. I mean, that happened.
Exactly
you know, that's the sort. And for what it's worth, why don't we play this sound, actually? Because this is Gianforte. I think this is part of his victory speech. And he also wants to offer a sincere apology for assaulting this guy. And what's interesting is not really the kind of pablum that he says, but how little the audience cares. And Matt made this point that for future reference, it would be more interesting to have the camera on the audience than on the candidate, because presumably there will be a lot more apologies as more Republicans, you know, physically assault people. I think it's going to be in another couple of years, it's going to be like, well, I respect my opponent, but he never punched a reporter. So I don't know how
you can expect it. If you think about it again, this stuff all escalates. Something that was not culturally acceptable becomes culturally acceptable, and then you take it to the next step. And somebody a little more unhinged goes that next step, you know. And it's inevitable.
Let's play the audio. But yeah. I think the point is that you're always going to get lunatics, and you're always going to have people who, you know, I mean, you had. That guy Carl Paladino from New York running for governor at one point. He never body slammed somebody, but there's a limit generally, or there has been in the past, where the voters actually punish people for something like this. And you could argue that it happened too late, but I'm quite convinced that there was really no way the voters were going to hold this guy to account in Montana. Anyways, Republicans.
Well, listen to the Republican audience in terms of how they respond to this, you know, generic apology he's trying to give. And obviously he's speaking to outside of the room, but the room's pretty revealing.
Last night, I learned a lesson. And no, please. I need to share something from my heart here, and I just ask you to bear with me. And when you make a mistake, you have to own up to it. That's the Montana way.
Amen. Amen.
Last night I made a mistake. And I took an action that I can't take back, and I'm not proud of what happened. I should not have responded in the way that I did. And for that, I'm sorry.
And you're forgiven.
I should not have treated that reporter that way. And for that, I'm sorry, Mr. Ben Jacobs.
Thank
I also want to apologize for the Fox News team that was there.
Well, that's important.
I'm sorry to each one of you.
Please still have me on.
That we had to go through this. That's not the person that I am. And it's not the way I'll lead in this state. Rest assured, our work is just beginning. But it does begin with me taking responsibility for my own actions. You deserve a congressman who stays out of the limelight and just gets the job done. I promise to work hard to protect our precious way of life.
Sorry I broke that Jew reporter's glasses, see? Now I'm going to go to Washington and take away your health care.
But you know what? What is amazing is how quickly they, I mean,
they don't care.
They were shot. They don't care. They don't care. In fact, and there may be an argument that it actually may have helped him in some way.
I think it did.
But
again, like as long as you can turn it into that, and you sort of said it yourself, Michael, when you're joking there, but as long as you turn it into that liberal Jew reporter, and you can make it about who it was and not what you did, which is what these guys do all the time, then it's okay. Because that's 30 or plus years of propaganda. They've so vilified reporters and anybody on the left, you know, and that it's at a point where if he'd done that to a good white upstanding rural folk from Montana while the guy was out hunting, you know, that might be a crime he should go to jail for. But it's okay because of who he did it to. And that's what it comes down to. That's what they've done to our country.
And let's not forget, that's exactly what the press release that they put out in response to Ben Jacobs reporting that he had just been body slammed before there was audio. That is right. Exactly the tactic they took. And so, I mean, if the guy was genuinely sincere, he would have been, I apologize, not just for the action that I took, but for assaulting this guy. I will, go down and deal with the police department. I also apologize for the press release we put out afterwards. I mean,
Right.
But that's the thing, like, he knows the game. They all are trained in this stuff. They know how this works, which is essentially he comes out afterwards, blames the guy, blames him for who he is, and makes it about left versus right, non-American, quote-unquote, you know, versus American, that kind of thing. And then Rush Limbaugh runs with it the next day. You know, Tucker Carlson sits on his dumbass show in Fox and repeats the same thing. And, you know, by the time it's all over, it's actually a reporter's fault, and it doesn't really matter what the truth is. They get that. You know what I mean? And that's what we've had to deal with for a long time. And we've kind of ignored that elephant in the room, that we've allowed that to proliferate and not done anything about it.
There is also the other story that, that Huffington Post has broke, which is that apparently the local NBC affiliate refused to air audio of the assault.
It's a Sinclair
Broadcasting Group, which we were just talking
about this yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is...
Again,
And I know, Cliff, that you know the Sinclair Media Group quite well.
I was a political analyst for Sinclair during the 2004 election. I was the liberal designated to argue with whoever the host was,
right,
and Armstrong Williams, another name we've all become reaccustomed to this election cycle. And that was what I did that regularly. And so I saw the inner workings of that whole beast. And the fact that they're being, I mean, again, I don't know what Democrats can do at this point. I don't know what the left can do at this point, because the Republicans control the FCC. They control, the majority government. But we allowed this to happen. A group like Sinclair, you know, they're the ones that put on that ridiculous documentary about John Kerry in 2004. They're the ones that refused to report on anything but positive stories from Iraq. We've let these guys go across the country. We've loosened ownership rules around media so that they can take over. And we're about to do it. They're about to take
over the FCC,
the Tribune Group.
Yes. Well, that is the thing, is that and Dayan and I talked about this yesterday. There apparently, and I've tried to find it, I can't find any more information, but apparently there's a suit because of the way in which the rules were relaxed. But it essentially allows Sinclair Media, and when we talked yesterday about that they were bad actors, I mean, the idea that they wouldn't run this is, I mean, just people should just take a step back, right, and just contemplate the idea of local news not running with audio of an assault by a guy who is about to be their congressman. I mean, that is,
now,
I mean,
right.
You know,
well, and now Sam, picture it all in concert together. So you live in Bozeman or, you know, whichever part of Montana, right? You know, wherever they say, I don't remember where that local news station is. They won't show it, but they'll probably give, they've got a right-wing commentator who comes out of their headquarters in Baltimore who's allowed to go on the end of local news for a couple minutes and give his opinion. So that guy gives you his opinion. They won't let you listen to the audio. Then on Fox News that night, they either don't cover it when you're watching that, because we're talking about the same voter here. They either won't cover it or they'll cover it from a right-wing slant. And then you turn on Rush Limbaugh the next day or you go read Breitbart. You get the same thing. You can live in that universe. These people comfortably do. And again, we've allowed it to happen. And so from their local news, from their national news, from what they read, they've gotten the same story, which is this guy did nothing wrong. If anything, he was a victim.
You know,
a liberal Jew reporter.
You know, there's this, I watched last night, I took an opportunity to watch the new Netflix documentary. I think it's called Get Me Roger Stone, but it's the Roger Stone documentary. And there's this moment where, you know, the guys who are making it are young, liberal, kind of, you know, whatever. And he's clearly loves being followed and he loves being on camera. And there's this moment where he's at Newsmax and he's getting followed around and some guy at Newsmax goes, oh, they're making a documentary about you. And Roger Stone goes, yeah, these guys are, you know, these are the young, you know, liberal leftists. They're following me around. You know, you can't trust those guys, but they're good guys. I like them. Right. And he's kind of saying this whole thing with a nod and a wink, which is his whole kind of brand. And the guy at Newsmax kind of looks dead into the camera. He's like, oh, yeah, I know who these people are. I hate them. And it's just like that kind of distinction between the people kind of pulling the strings and operating with complete cynicism. And then a little bit down the food chain of like, oh, yeah, no, I hate this guy. You know, and I would imagine that person would have absolutely no problem with somebody being physically assaulted.
The worst part of all this, again, is some of it sped up because the Republicans took control, but it's sort of the chicken or the egg. One of the big reasons they took control, one of the big reasons, you know, Florida in 2000 went down the way it did. One of the big reasons impeachment went down the way it did. And you know, Bill Clinton and these other things are because of the kind of control they took of the information flow. And we understood this, you know, because of the lessons we learned right after World War II, what happens to a society when you allow propaganda to become mainstreamed and you allow, you know, that to be considered mainstream and take over. And, you know, like so often happens, it just seems to me the more I watch where we are today and trace it back, it started, you know, with the Reagan Revolution in the 80s and you get rid of the, I mean, I'm not talking about all the other stuff, but you get rid of the fairness doctrine. Mm-hmm. You start allowing, you know, these conglomerates to at that point we had some like 60 something media companies, maybe more than that. You allow the big guys to start eating up smaller players. By the 90s, you've even got Bill Clinton signing the telecommunications, you know, quote unquote reform. So, I mean, he allowed them. Mario Cuomo relaxed rules while he's governor of New York. You know, we're complicit in this, so, you know, in how they're allowed to control the airwaves and the flow of information. Again, a lot of people just don't understand that Rupert Murdoch, you know, being able to let's say if you're a voter from New Jersey, tell you that Chris Christie is great via the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, Fox News, local Fox, and whatever else. That was an impossibility 30, 40 years ago.
Yep.
And we've made that all acceptable now.
Do you guys have any thoughts on, I mean, I think it was a 7-point margin. It wasn't a blowout.
And, six, actually.
Or 6-point margin. So Chris, you know, he seemed like he performed as good as you're maybe going to perform in the present context in Montana. But looking forward, I mean, if Ossoff wins in Georgia, and obviously I want Ossoff to win in Georgia, but I'm just thinking from the perspective of this kind of the debate inside Democratic politics, and maybe some people on the kind of Bernie side oversold what Quist could do to begin with in a really hard race. But then on the, you know, the sort of more neoliberal or third way wing, whatever you want to call it, they might jump on it and say, look, see, he came out, he was pro-legalizing marijuana, he supported single payer, Bernie campaigned for him, it still doesn't work. And then if Ossoff comes around and wins in a sort of, you know, conservative Democrat kind of budget hawkery way, I'm just wondering, I mean, or does it not matter? You know, I mean, this debate's going to continue regardless, but I'm just saying, like, what's the danger of using, especially a race like that, that's so uphill, as a kind of proxy for bigger arguments?
Every, well, everybody who has a perspective and everybody who has a dog in the fight are going to attempt to build those narratives. I mean, right. To a large extent, that's the greatest relevance of these elections in and of themselves. I mean, Dayan made the point yesterday that the healthcare bill only passed by two votes in the House, and that may be the case. But I think there's probably a little bit more elasticity. If they needed those votes, they could find those two votes. But the point being that these special elections are all about narrative building. You know, there's a couple of things that I think, you know, that could come out of this, ranging from the less agenda filled to the more agenda filled. But Montana is a place where Trump won very big. Georgia 6 is a place where Trump only won by a point and a half.
Right.
And so that could come into the equation. So John in San Antonio, if you're listening right now, you may want to revise the map that he's been using in terms of where people should be looking for congressional candidates to pick up. But the other thing is what Quist didn't do, and which, you know, I think will get overlooked, is Quist didn't run any negative ads against Gianforte. And, you know, apparently Gianforte is not a particularly good candidate. And, he didn't run
the
any
whole
ads
stuff about that.
B, he also was outspent 7-1 in terms of outside expenditures.
Right.
And there's just no way you're going to compete against, a billionaire, frankly.
Right. You have to be able to look at the various factors in this race. In other words, it's not as simple as Quist was more of a populist candidate. Ossoff, you know, obviously is running in a more sort of district where, as Sam was pointing out, you've got some formerly suburban Republicans who've become Democrats and are more economically or more fiscally conservative, whatever you want to call it, or at least in their heads they are.
Upscale, suburban, more kind of corporate
district.
Right,
so you have to say, you know, Montana is the type of state, like rural parts of Ohio where I live, you know, where that Trump overperformed it. So right away, Trump is not going to be nearly as much of a negative in a place like Montana as we would wish him to be. He still is because his numbers have gone down and because he's unpopular overall and various things. But I didn't even know, you know, so you start off with that the Ossoff race to me, this race and the one in Kansas, you could say performance in terms of improvement matters. Mm-hmm. And the fact that this guy only lost by 6 points when congressionals and, you know, Republicans in Montana generally win by double digits, that's a big deal. But Ossoff really has to win. There's no sort of booby prize there. You can't be like excited by losing by a point,
right?
You know, because it's that one has gotten a lot closer because of the rejection of Trump. And so I think we'll have to see what happens. You know, I would just say you bring in those other factors. I didn't even know that Quist hadn't run negative ads. I mean, Gianforte, one of the biggest issues there that ends up being an issue that crosses party lines is the fact that he wouldn't allow people to fish on his land and sued to stop them. So if Ossoff if Quist didn't even run any negative ads on that, that's sort of malpractice. I just learned that literally right now because I didn't know that.
Yeah, I would think that would be the whole ad budget could just have been on that.
Well, that's the problem. But then the second thing is, you know, and again, how we stop this, I'm coming to clearer how I think we should stop this, which is the money that flows into these things is – you know, but in the end, the independent expenditures ended up being worth about $650,000 in favor of Quist. In favor of Gianforte, it was $5.6 million.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you're going up against that, and to me, we haven't been able to do anything. I would honestly I would tell people what we know is happening, even if we don't have the proof in that particular case, which is, your opponent brings in $5 million, you start questioning them which of that money is Russian and which of it's Chinese. So at this point, we know that foreign money is coming into our election. And it's pouring in. They're finding ways to through LLCs and shell companies and multinationals to launder it into our election. And, you know, maybe as these investigations go on, we'll learn even more about that. But, I mean, it's ridiculous. Because nobody knows where the hell that money came from, quite frankly.
I there's a lot of negative places I would rather go before I would start to, you know, and not because I think that we would start World War III with the Chinese, or I just think that's, I mean, if that's a way of attempting to tie Trump into it, but I think there's a lot, if you're going to go negative on a guy like Gianforte, I don't think there's a lot of Republican voters out there who are going to get caught up in the, in the whole, where's this money coming from? Is it coming from a foreign country thing? Because they didn't care with Trump terribly much either, you know?
No. But we know more now.
But don't you think with the sort of the extent that there's persuadable voters, and this is specific to Montana, if you say, here's an out-of-state interloper who sued to stop you from using his land to fish. And by the way, his whole policy portfolio for Congress, in addition to screwing you on health care and supporting this abomination, which nobody likes, he is campaigning explicitly on messing with federal lands, which practically translates to you and your whole lifestyle is jeopardized by it. And by the way, incidentally, he'll go out and talk about guns. He's going to eliminate all the places you can hunt.
The bottom line is you need to go negative, particularly in these races where you're going to be outspent this much. I mean, it's one thing for Bernie to maintain this thing, and it's part of his, you know, it's part of his core brand proposition. Forgive me.
Well, thank you.
It's part of his core brand proposition.
But
that
it hurt him too. It's also not a way to win.
Well, it may have and it may not have.
I don't know
about that. But with him, it's something that he's built over the course of a 30-year career.
Right.
If you're coming out and you're an unknown quantity and you're running in a race for Congress, I think pointing out the negatives of your opponent is, you know, that's part of the of politics. And so I don't know if it would necessarily be, I would go the route about the funding sources, but whatever. I think as a broad proposition, that's, you know, that's that. But I guess we're going to have to wait.
I didn't even know that, Sam, that he hadn't done that. I think that was a terrible
mistake.
That's
my understanding. I may be wrong, but that's my understanding. Now, granted, he had a small amount of money and he wanted to introduce himself to people, but
he was known. He's a local. He's kind of a local celebrity. I mean, that's incredible malpractice. I mean,
And I think, you know, when you're talking about an election where you already have a certain amount of energy on your side, you know, part of it is you want to deplete the energy on the other side. But let's move on to talk about some other stuff too.
I know we're running up against it, and obviously, I mean, I know that maybe you might leave us early, Sam, but let's go just briefly. Let's talk about, there's confirmation now that Jared Kushner is being looked at by the FBI with regards to this Russia stuff. There was that great exchange, I played it a couple of weeks ago, where Al Franken asked Sally Yates something to the effect of, you know, maybe the reason that they didn't want to move on Flynn was that there's somebody else who's very important to the president and to the team that's also being looked at. And maybe, you know, and he kind of sort of laid it out very kind of ironically and tongue in cheek, and she didn't want to touch it. But this has been floating around for a while, and now it looks like it's more, there's more confirmation of it.
Right.
And this
was
is just
the Washington Post story.
Yeah, Washington Post story. Right. Right.
That said, a senior advisor in the White House. And remember, Bannon said in April through other sources, right, when they were having that fight between Kushner and Bannon, that I think Kushner's relationship with the Russians or meetings with the Russians is going to be a problem down the road. And so it could very well be that he's got, and I think, you know, we've been saying this for some time, Michael, we're anticipating that there's probably financial crimes be at the heart of this. And that would make the most amount of sense to me. Although
there's the financial aspect of it, which I think is definitely, because Kushner has shown himself to be just as greedy as his father-in-law. Especially the whole family, where they're selling Chinese visas and all the other stuff. But I'd say second of all,
Cliff, would you remind everybody briefly when Jared Kushner's dad went to jail, what did that involve, including what did he do to his own sister? Do you remember that story?
God, I'm trying to remember. I know that he was trying to.
It involved bribery, but he basically part
bribery
of one
and, like,
of
the, he was,
He was trying to set his brother-in-law up with a hooker.
That's right.
Yeah. So just that's,
and get it on tape to right. to. I'm trying to remember if to embarrass them and somehow hurt them financially because he was in a battle
right.
with them.
Right.
This is how the Kushner family treats each other. Remember that Donald Trump tried to deny his nephew, who needed it, health care because he was angry at his brother, his dead brother, I believe, at the time. These are the kinds of people you're dealing with.
I prefer nephews that are healthy.
Well, also, let's remember what Tyrion did to Joffrey in Game of Thrones. So, I mean, this is
yeah, we see this all the time. That, so I can't really. But the thing here is that you know, Kushner clearly seems to have about the same basic moral structure as Trump does.
Right.
And we already know that Trump has trusted him with just about everything, considering his portfolio is everything from, you know, like landing us on Jupiter by, you know, 2060, actually more like 2030.
We go to Mars and we personally loot there. The treasury. You're in charge of all of it, Jared. Right,
to eliminating all disease, right. You know, at some point during the second term. I mean, this guy does everything. He trusts him with everything. It would sort of be beyond belief that hard to believe he wouldn't have trusted him.
They share a girlfriend.
Send somebody to those meetings with these Russians. And somebody was going to be the contact, you know, and there was collusion. You'd have to believe, just like he brought the family into the White House, the family was brought into it.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, this is going to continue. It's going to create more pressure on Trump. And there's obviously, like, they have leaks inside the White House. And I think this is where, you know, more of this is going to go. I think we're supposedly going to hear from Comey next week. But, you know, somebody's going to end up getting, you know, caught at the very least in lying to FBI agents. And I don't, you know, it's going to be interesting to see if over the next like a month or two, we don't see some preemptive pardons of, you know, Flynn. I mean, you know, remember when Flynn's lawyer said he's got stories to tell?
Yep.
It's quite possible that Flynn was assisting Jared in getting, you know, some type of financial dealings. I mean, we just don't know. And I think, but it's hard to imagine that down the road, we're not going to see more about this, that it's not going to turn out to have to do with like financial stuff. And let's just turn. I don't want to spend, I want to just turn for a moment to like the idea of what we're seeing simultaneously, because, you know, Michael brought up the point about everybody adopting the perspective on the quiz race to fit their narrative. And, you know, part of that is that the Democrats should not be relying exclusively or maybe even primarily on this intrigue stuff, but rather should be, you know, fighting with politics. And yesterday there was what I thought was a pretty substantial minimum wage proposal rolled out by Pelosi and Schumer.
Yeah,
that would get to $15 an hour, 2024. It's a little bit longer of a timeline, but it also would be then pegged to median wage increases, which is really important.
That's the I thought that was the most significant part of that, right?
And that's good things to see while this is happening.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead, Cliff.
Because, I mean, look, to me, the common factor in these races so far is the drop-off on the Republican side. You know, the drop-off among, and you see it, Nate Silver sent out something about how people don't think Trump's base is shrinking. It is actually shrinking. That he's losing people that were feeling very positive towards him, you know, that kind of thing. But the other side of the equation is, it's true. I don't think that you find a common thread necessarily on the Democratic side. So maybe that is what's missing. You know, I'm not saying that would have changed the results of some of these other elections that all were in very hostile territory. But maybe it's the kind of thing that for 2018, having a unified message going up that perfectly contrasts you with all this crap that they're doing is, you know, that's what takes you way over the top.
And maybe isn't it like realizing, I think what each of those, they serve two different functions. For broad purposes and to talk to most people, I think, yeah, you need to talk to them about raising their wages, about college affordability. I mean, you know, real stuff that affects them day in and day out. What the Russia stuff seems to do, though, that's where it's proven to be really effective is, one is, yes, we always say we think it's some type of financial crime. There is something there that needs to be investigated. But then it clearly drives Trump insane. And then it also delays the Republican schedule because, you know, the day, like within 24 hours or something, like, you know, they were moving towards the healthcare markup in the Senate, and then he fires Comey, and now we're back to, like, all of this insanity. And then, of course, you know, he goes overseas, and then it's the usual cycle where he gives one speech that's scripted right. about Saudi Arabia, and everybody goes, oh, he's so presidential, blah, blah. Even though, incidentally, while he's there, he's in a sea of the worst thugs on the planet and praising them. But being that as May, maybe that is presidential. But I'm just saying, it seems like if we could just understand the different purposes for, like, a broader message that will either appeal to getting Democrats out for something other than hating Trump, and for, you know, peeling off whatever group is in the middle or undecided, however tiny that percentage is, but we know that this comes down to really small margins, that's where you have the minimum wage proposal. But then it's just
or
in terms of
people in the middle.
But disrupting Trump and the Republicans, that's what this Russia thing is doing. It makes them freaked out and off their game.
I would add that I think the irony is, I think the Russia stuff, all that intrigue, actually impacts the politicians more in some respects than, or at least that's the biggest delta going from, like, you know, what they would be doing otherwise to how timid it makes them, because they spend a lot of their time watching the cable news. And so it's,
I'm not the only one.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But it creates this weird dynamic where there's, like, two different narratives going on, which I don't think is necessarily problematic, but and I would also say that in terms of, you know, a national thing for people to run on in terms of Democrats, it could very well end up being healthcare. Right. And you're starting to see, like, the single payer rollouts in the House and the Senate from the Democrats. And right now, the Republicans in the Senate are working, you know, supposedly McConnell doesn't have 50 votes yet, but they're working on it right now.
Right.
And they're not doing it. You're not watching the sausage, but it's being made. And I think people underestimate just, like, where they're going to be able to get to and how much, you know, they may come out with buying on to the repeal now and the replace later, or, you know, I just think that it's very compelling for Republicans to roll back, because people have to remember these are tax cuts. The healthcare is really just, like, is the second order of problems they have. Their primary goal is to get these tax cuts, and they're going to get there in some fashion or another. I'm quite convinced of it. And this is going to be something for Democrats to rail against. But let me, I gotta jump off. But you guys should also talk about NATO and
we're not.
France is now ascendant with their handshakes.
I played that in the opening, and it was just, I mean, I'm not a Macron fan, but I'm becoming one. I mean, geez, man, he really
does.
Listen,
you don't have
to
agree with all of his policies to be a fan of how he treats our president.
Absolutely.
Those are distinct things.
Exactly.
It's like amazing.
Exactly.
It really is amazing. All right. Well, look, I'll be back live on Tuesday. Talk to you guys later.
Yeah, no show on Monday. Thanks, Sam.
All right.
Bye-bye. Take care, bye. Sam.
Yeah, so Cliff, I mean, we already played it, but we can, you know, you can use the Macron. Are you still there, Cliffy?
I'm here.
Okay, great. Yeah, so you can use the Macron as a sort of doorway into, you know, actually, let me just editorialize for 30 seconds. The fact that last week you still had people like Bob Schieffer talking about Trump's Saudi speech, which incidentally was written by that little disgusting, you know, that's that profile of an aspiring school shooter, Stephen Miller, was written by him, who is a notorious bigot against, you know, Muslims, Mexicans,
everything.
And yeah, everything. Disgusting. And the speech was, yes, it was presidential in the sense that he went to Saudi Arabia and he hugged up against
he went to Saudi Arabia. He's officially the president and he spoke. So
and
I
he's
guess that makes
literally presidential. And you know what? He went and he realized, and he obviously McMaster and some other people that have, you know, a fraction of an understanding of the world got to him. And you know what else? I bet the Saudis got to him. I think Donald Trump, when I see him with the Saudi family, I think that is a synergy that makes sense, just like with the Bushes. It's oil, it's religion, it's hierarchy.
Yeah.
And so
you should think to yourself, though, with the Saudis, I believe you're exactly right when it comes to the Bushes. That was their synergy with the Bushes.
Right.
It was, but the synergy with Trump is pure, flat out corruption.
Pure and interior decoration.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Oh, yeah. Definitely they have the same interior decorator. But the thing is that any of these countries where it is basically a dictatorship, there's a reason why Trump gets along with all of them better than anybody else. And there's a reason why magically his projects go up in places like Turkey and Saudi Arabia and whatever. It's because there's no red tape to cut through there. There's no bidding on projects. There's no whatever. Here's my handshake. I control everything. I can take whatever money I want from the pot, give it to you, go build something. I mean, he gets along with the authoritarian better. Partially because he admires them and likes the way that they beat up on people, but partially because he can do whatever business he wants with the Saudis. He can do whatever business he wants with the Turks. He can do whatever business he wants in Russia, in China, because there's nobody has to vote for it. Right. There's no transparency. And so, of course, he the body language is that of love there because he's making money.
And just innate admiration for money in and of itself. Like, when we think about the modern Republican Party, and we'll get to the NATO summit in a second, but they have said for decades that pretty much your net assets are a measure of your worth, period. And then you add the weird religious conservatism. So when the Russia stuff started, I mean, I said, look, Vladimir Putin would be the perfect Republican candidate. He actually is what all of these guys fantasize themselves to be. He is a brutal, corrupt killer who's worth billions of dollars. And now I would add, besides the color of their skin and their religion, the Saudis as well. Great Republicans.
Michael, not that you don't know, but for everybody else's sake, and I'm sure most of them do know, but how did Putin start his career? Where was he?
He was in East Germany as a KGB operative.
That's right. So he was working for the communist government.
Right.
And then the moment came where he could be an authoritarian as a fascist. It doesn't matter to him.
Right.
Whatever system a personality like Putin came up in, he was going to try to acquire power, money, all the things that go along with that. That makes it, frankly, no different than Trump,
right.
No different than the Saudis. They'd been born in a different country where it wasn't Sharia that got them where they wanted to go.
Right.
They'd take something else.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And trust funds and everything else. Yeah.
Yes, these guys are all the same. And many of these Republican members of Congress, you know, who body slam reporters and threaten reporters or whatever, their only constraints on them are the fact that we are, at least at this moment in time, still a country that has at least somewhat of a rule of law. If they existed in any of these other countries we're talking about, they would be behaving just like those guys are. So that's what is important to remember here. So, I mean, Trump fits in perfectly. Of course, there's a sort of perfect synergy with these guys. And of course, he smiles his way through Saudi Arabia. And then he goes to NATO and meets with members of the European community and others in NATO who have prided themselves on, you know, and I'm not claiming it's a perfect measure. I'm not claiming they've done. But in terms of, you compare it to where the world has been, and where we hope to go, on democracies, on actually caring about people other than just the rich, on, you know, an alliance to prevent war, things that are about greater service, not just serving yourself, he doesn't get along so well because, of course, he doesn't understand that. That concept's foreign to him.
And,
and you can see it in the way all the other leaders were basically like literally, you felt like they were second graders almost sitting in the back of a health class hearing the word penis for the first time. Like, if you saw the way they were giggling and laughing while Trump was talking, that's what it reminded me of. Like, they couldn't stop themselves from laughing at this moron who was up and saying these ridiculous things. And then we see the way Macron treated Trump and walked directly away from him. I mean, this is the way all these guys feel about him, because that's the way they also feel about Putin and Erdogan and Ferdinand. I'm mispronouncing their names, but he's one of them.
We're going to play, I believe this is up, this is where he Trump scolding NATO members for not paying their fair share. And, you know, I agree with what you're saying, and I think this is a really important point now, particularly for, you know, the left, and you know, the degrees of left. I'm probably to the left of you, but I think that the difference between saying that there is a system exemplified by institutions like NATO and the European Union and the World Bank and the IMF that do radically and disproportionately favor Western interests, Western corporations. They've imposed austerity from Latin America and Africa, and now inside the Eurozone, there's a democracy deficit. There's a lot of corruption. NATO was probably quite too aggressive in terms of encroaching on Russian territory after the end of the Cold War. And by the way, we did to Russia in the 1990s, what, along with their local criminals and plutocrats, what people like Trump and Ryan want to do here. We looted the public services, we threw tons of people into poverty, and we turned it into a dystopian nightmare. And that's another mark against the Clinton administration. Now, that said, there is a big distinction between saying, do we want to evolve into a better system and use the institutional arrangements that we have that also have worked for some other things, including some development in international law, some environmental frameworks, some sense of mutually assured, you know, security obligations in Europe, which have allowed the modern Europeans to create some very advanced social welfare states and businesses and environmental policies? Or do we just devolve into, you know, return into a purely real politique world, which is what people like Erdogan, Putin, and Trump want.
Right, so that's what you get. That's why I'm not saying, you know, you and I don't agree necessarily on see everything 100% the same, but I think we see things mostly the same.
Right.
And it's not for me to sit here and say that any of these institutions have been perfect and haven't had plenty of problems. It's that it's still at least the vision of these institutions are that of countries working together to prevent war. And however you view it, whether it's the UN, whether it's NATO or the EU or whatever it is, those types of at least military alliances make it much less likely that there will be war.
Exactly. And it's the same with trade agreements. Trump campaigned against terrible trade agreements, but he didn't promise to make them better. In fact, the bilateral approach would make them even worse. But let's play Trump calling out the Europeans for supposedly not paying their dues.
2% is the bare minimum for confronting today's very real and very vicious threats. If NATO countries made their full and complete contributions, then NATO would be even stronger than it is today, especially from the threat of terrorism.
What's he talking about there, Cliff?
I'm not sure he knows what he's talking about. I like it, the vicious threats.
Yes.
You know, it reminds me of severe conservatism. I mean, you know, so obviously there's an agreement in place already predating him from many of these countries to add more to defense. They've signed it.
Right.
He, of course, doesn't acknowledge that at all. He's completely playing to populism here. And then he has the nerve to obviously bring up terrorism at the end there after what literally just happened in Manchester. Can you imagine if a European leader came to the United States, lectured us on spending too little money on defense, and brought up terrorism right after 9/11. Can you imagine how we'd react to that?
Well, I think we'd be really receptive to the thoughtful criticisms. Well, but it also shows, too, though, that, again, this notion that, like, terrorism is not going to be defeated or handled militarily. It's going to be defeated through, you know, mainly intelligence and disruption of networks. So it's also this stupid, you know, kind of assumption. But, you know, you're right. You're looking at this kind of sweep of leaders looking at him, and no matter what moments Fareed Zakaria or Bob Schaefer get excited about his supposed newfound presidentialism, look at his main peers.
Every week.
Look at their faces. Look at them. You know, assess this guy, and even if you're, you know, Noam Chomsky, I think you will actually find it just embarrassing.
I think, there's nothing else you can find it, no matter what your views are. This goes beyond sort of political views. This is whether somebody has the gravitas, the intelligence, you know, just what it takes to be a leader of the country, you know, and he doesn't even come close. I mean, it's not like he's sort of just below the line. One can make an argument that Bush didn't, you know, the last Bush didn't rise to that level either. This guy's so far below that. It's ludicrous. So, I mean, and it just, it embarrasses us and it hurts us. In a lot of ways, it will hurt. I mean, you know, you start seeing things like tourism way down, whatever, which hurts our pocketbook.
Foreign investment is down as well.
Yep. There's a lot more to it than that. You know, there's long-term views of this country that he's changing right now.
Right.
But, you know, that can harm us in all sorts of ways, some of which we can't even probably think of. So it's, you know, it's embarrassing again. And I'm kind of prepared for it every time he does it, because I expect it. But still, when it actually happens, when he stands here lecturing these people like a jackass, when he busts his way through and knocks the leader of Montenegro out of the way, by the way, Russia tried to keep out of NATO. And one could argue whether they, you know, about that forever. We don't need to get into that. But point being, whether that was aimed purposefully at him or is just Trump being the little boy in class who has to get to the front of the line, either way,
yeah, I think that's
that's embarrassing. I mean, that Macron felt he could put that up on Twitter and that more people in the world would appreciate it than not appreciate it, at least in his world, who he's appealing
to.
That, you know, that he just basically ignored Trump when Trump put his arms out to go over to a number of other leaders first. I mean, these are all things, they hurt us. This hurts us.
Yeah.
We'll have a debt to pay when we're done, when this guy's gone.
Yeah, and I think, and again, I don't want to undermine, like, obviously George Bush led a tremendous catastrophe across the globe. Ronald Reagan supported all sorts of horrific rebel movements, and, you know, Barack Obama, you know, had an absolutely out-of-control drone program. But I think that some people, again, and you know, this would be my final thought on this, and I would get final thoughts from you. But I think that we, you know, especially I'll identify, you know, people in my sort of strain of politics. There was this underappreciation of even just some of the, you know, okay, there's a hypocrisy of talking about human rights when we have a terrible human rights record. But the notion that now we've just sort of, we're going to have a guy that just devolves and just sees it as pure, you know, I wish I could do what Duterte was doing. I wish I could have, you know, a drug war that is just a social cleansing of my political opponents. In some ways, that actually is what the Republican drug war and Democratic drug war is racially here. But, you know, it really matters. And I don't know. I mean, maybe it's almost like maybe some people are saying maybe we should just eliminate the presidency from here. There's no way that the office could be restored. We need to go to some type of prime ministerial system.
And again, look, maybe this is just my way. It's a certain optimism or whatever.
Yeah.
All I can do is compare us to others and compare us to the times.
Right.
And I will constantly say, there's a lot we need to improve, just like the institutions I was talking about before, but they're the light. And when you compare it to what's going on in Turkey and Saudi Arabia,
right,
and those are frankly not even the two worst places by far, you know, you compare this is the only sort of progressive path forward. I mean, I'm staring here on Twitter at a picture of the first ladies from NATO joining each other and the husband of the prime minister of Luxembourg, the first gay first gentleman, has joined them for this picture.
Wow.
I want one to try to imagine that happening in Saudi Arabia or in Russia.
Or in America.
Or in Turkey.
Or in America, yeah.
What'd you say?
I said or in America right now, but yes.
Well, yeah,
I take
right
your
now.
Point. Yeah.
I'm just saying that this is a vision of moving, of where we can head to. With all the austerity politics and all the many things that I've been critical of, you have been critical of, and they've done wrong, still, this is hopefully, you know, the vision that we have moving forward is this. And this is the vision that Donald Trump is rejecting.
Yep.
For one dominated by those who live in a state of nature where they take whatever they want and they treat their people however they want and they randomly impose whatever rules they want.
And preferably you were born with it all already, so we don't even need to have any opening in the system. It can just be keep getting handed off and re-entrenched and reinforced.
That's right.
Yep. So, well, Cliffy,
those would be my final thoughts.
Well, it was great to talk with you as always. I'm sure we'll do this more often. Cliff Schechter, thank you so much.
My pleasure, too.
All right, man.
Thanks for having me on, man.
Take care. Okay, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half where there's more sound, more stories, more goodness. The IMs are on 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We're going to do an update on what's happening in the UK. Take your calls and IMs. No call, no show on Monday. We're back live on Tuesday. Support the Majority Report in all the ways you can support it. And we will see you in the fun half. Thank you.